come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love him.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank.
Welcome back. I'm Bill Frank. At the outbreak of World War II, the United States was in no way prepared for war. And to defeat Nazi Germany, the Allies had to crush the vaunted Luftwaffe, the most powerful and battle-hardened air force in the world. No invasion of Europe would be fought without air superiority. The United States was faced with the challenge of turning amateurs into an air force that could take down the Luftwaffe. My next guest has written the first in-depth examination of America's most distinguished bomber group, the 303rd Bomb Group flying from Molesworth, England. His book, Hell's Angels, The True Story of the 303rd Bomb Group in World War II, chronicles America's efforts to destroy Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. Jay Stout is a retired Marine Corps fighter pilot. Lieutenant Colonel Stout flew more than 4,500 flight hours, including 37 combat missions during Operation Desert Storm. Following his military career, Lieutenant Colonel Stout worked for a very short time as an airline pilot before he was furloughed after the terror attacks of September 11, 2001. He subsequently flew for the Kuwaiti Air Force for a year before returning to the United States, where he now works as a senior analyst for a leading defense contractor. Lieutenant Colonel Stout's expertise is widely recognized, and he's made many appearances as a combat aviation expert on news networks like Fox, Al Jazeera, and National Public Radio. Joining us from the San Diego area to discuss daylight precision bombing during World War II, welcome to the show, Jay. How are you today?
Very good. Thanks so much for asking, Bill.
Well, thank you for being my guest. And first of all, let me just start out by saying thank you for your years of service and your combat for the United States. We're all grateful to you for that.
Thanks so much. I thank you all for the paycheck.
Well, we're glad to pay and have you out there on the front line, so thank you for all that you do. Now, let's dive into your book, because I was fascinated by this subject. And now, of course, you know, we're celebrating the 70th anniversary, the end of World War II, so we've got a lot of hindsight that we can look back on World War II. But during World War II itself, the British and the Americans took dramatically different approaches to bombing Nazi industrial might. The British, they pursued nighttime bombing raids, while the United States pursued daylight precision bombing. So I guess the first question that I want to ask you after doing all of this research was, is daylight bombing, was it the best option for the United States Army Air Force in World War II if, as you write, the early pilots and the early crews were amateurs?
Well, first I'll address your comment on the amateurs. I use that term because when you consider that in 1940, the United States Army Air Corps at the time had only 25,000 men, and in 1944, they had 2.5 million men. What that meant in 1944 was that only 1 in 100 men had been on the job for more than 4 years. So they weren't careerists. They were just 2 or 3 years removed from pushing and shoving in the school lunch line. And then daylight precision bombing was something the United States Army Air Corps and later the Army Air Forces had been pursuing. That was their doctrine for more than 10 years. So they were mechanized for it. They were trained for it. This is what they were going to do when the war started, because that's really the only thing they knew how to do. If they had to switch to nighttime bombing, it would have taken 2 or 3 years to retrain the Air Force and to re-equip it for night bombing.
All right, but let's look at the reality, Jay. I mean, there were 30 to 40% casualty figures during the years 1942 and 1943. That meant for every 10 airplanes we put up, only 6 or 7 would return back, and we would lose those crews. And remember that each of those bombers held about 10 bomber personnel, so we were losing 30, 40 people at a whack out of each of the squadrons. Was that acceptable?
Certainly it was acceptable because we ended up winning the war. And that 30 to 40% casualty rate, that was over a 25-mission tour, which was typical early in the war. So up until about mid-1944 and a little bit later, an air crewman had about a 50-50 chance of being shot down. And if he was shot down, there was a 50% chance that he would be killed. So the casualty rate, as you mentioned, was high. It was about 25%. For single missions, like the first two missions to Schweinfurt, the casualties were horrendous. of all the bombers sent out, 20% of them were shot down. And that could not be sustained on a daily basis. So you make a good point in that the casualty rate was horrendous. But ultimately, it was sustainable because we had the industrial might behind us and we had very well-trained personnel and a lot of them.
Well, that we did. And to really hone in on that point about our industrial might, most Americans won't realize that by the beginning of World War II, the United States was producing more airplanes for Lend-Lease than Germany and Japan were at that exact same time. And both of those countries were engaged in the war. My guest is Jay Stout. He is the author of the new book, Hell's Angels, The True Story of the 303rd Bomber Group in World War II. And Jay, you mentioned about these horrific losses. Things did turn around in 1944, as you say, with really the introduction of the P-51 Mustang, a long-range fighter that could support the bombers. How did fighter support really change the course of the war?
What that fighter support did, and you mentioned it, the P-51, and they actually extended the range of the P-47, and the P-38 had pretty good long legs. But what it did was it allowed the Allies to go wherever they needed to hit strategic targets. There was a time up until about December 1943 or January 1944 where the United States had a strategic air force that was incapable of hitting strategic targets because every time they went beyond the range of their escorting fighters, they sustained horrific losses, which they could not endure for any length of time at all. So for a brief period, we had a very impotent strategic air force, and that long-range fighter, the P-51, and the other fighters I mentioned, allowed us finally to go wherever we needed to go to hit what targets needed to be hit when they needed.
All right, Jay, let me change it up on you if I can just a little bit and ask you about the commanders of both the American and the British Air Forces because they were interesting characters in and of themselves. And first, let's start with the overriding question. Was the Bomber Command for the British and the Americans, was it led by competent leaders? And in the case of the British, it was Britain's Bomber Harris. America was led by Ira Eaker.
Fortunately, the answer is yes. We had very competent leadership, especially when compared to the German leadership. Ira Eaker was gifted technically. He was a great pilot. He understood politics. People liked him, and he was a hard worker. He also played real hard, and he understood that the relationship between the Americans and the British had to be maintained. Early on, he was hosted at a British event, and they asked him to speak, and he had just newly arrived, and he earned a lot of respect when he said, I'm not going to speak a lot because we haven't done much. And I hope that when we're gone, you're glad that we were here. And then he sat down. Bomber Harris also was a very, very competent leader. He was very strong-willed, very strong-minded. He is criticized for the area bombing, the firebombing of a lot of German cities. But there's no arguing the fact that when you dehouse, when you displace hundreds of thousands of civilians and workers and you burn whole portions of cities, that has a strategic effect regardless of how gruesome it was.
Well, you mentioned Bomber Harris being controversial, and that's to say the least. In history has not been kind to him at all. In fact, we look back on that and we wonder, was his policy of pursuing the firebombing of cities like Dresden and others in Germany, you say that there was some strategic objective to that, but others take the argument that it was purely revenge for the bombing of London during World War II. Where do you stand on that?
I certainly think that there was some element of giving some back to the Germans, but remember the British had tried daylight bombing very early in the war and had suffered very badly. They just didn't have the equipment for it. Their aircraft weren't suitable for it, so they switched to night bombing. And it was very difficult, particularly early in the war, to hit specific targets at night. It was virtually impossible. So the only recourse they had was area bombing, and they mechanized their air force for night bombing, area bombing, just as we had mechanized our Air Force for daytime bombing. We were both trained and equipped for different types of bombing. But later in the war, the British actually developed a number of systems that were capable of bombing more precisely than much earlier in the war.
My guest is Jay Stout. He is the author of the new book, Hell's Angels, The True Story of the 303rd Bomb Group in World War II. And Jay, you mentioned about the strategic advantages of daylight bombing versus nighttime bombing. The United States had one really strategic advantage that allowed them to perform this precision daylight bombing, and that was the Norden bomb site. Now, for those who don't know, the Norden bomb site was an analog computer. It was tied into the bomber's autopilot, and it actually allowed the bombardier to fly the airplane over the target zone, revolutionary in its time. So my question to you is this. You know, the Americans were very giving during Lend-Lease, and we shared a lot with our allies, but why were the Americans stingy in sharing the Norden bomb site technology with their allies? I mean, after all, the British gave us the Merlin engine that allowed the P-51 to be our superior fighter escort. Why were we so stingy with the Norden?
The short answer is that they really didn't need it. They had a bomb site, the Mark 14, which below 20,000 feet was actually just about as good as the Norden. And it stabilized itself pretty quickly, which was important because the British bombers maneuvered quite heavily, oftentimes during their bomb runs. So it was well-suited for the work they needed. But it's also important to remember the Norden was almost useless at night. It required the bombardier to acquire the target through a telescope at fairly long range, and that was not possible in low-light conditions with the Norden. So the British had the bomb site they needed, and the Norden really wasn't suited for the sorts of operations they did.
My guest is Jay Stout. And Jay, earlier in one of your answers, you mentioned how Ira Aker endeared himself to the British when he came over and was very, very subdued in his approach about what we were going to be able to provide the British and how we were going to be able to help them. But I find it very interesting that the Brits on the ground, the people that were actually living in Great Britain at the time, had an expression for our American flyers. And the expression went like this: they're overpaid, they're oversexed, and they're over here. What are the implications of the influx of so many American aviators on Great Britain?
You can imagine that there were social and economic implications. Put yourself in the shoes of a young British soldier or airman. He's got a pretty little girlfriend or a nice wife and a child, and he's getting ready to get shipped off to North Africa or the Far East or somewhere else. And here comes hundreds of thousands of young Americans. They're exotic to the British people. They're exciting. They're lively. They've got a lot of money. That British airman and British soldier is rightly going to be a little sensitive to how those Americans are going to upset his home life. On the other hand, the Americans spent a lot of money over there, and certainly the British business people appreciated that money. And ultimately, as different as we were, the similarities overcame those differences, and by and large, the relationship was very, very good.
My guest is Jay Stout. Jay, I want to look at history giving a bad rap to certain aircraft that are out there. I mean, when you look back, so much emphasis post-war has been given to the B-17s. Beautiful aircraft, nothing to take away from it. But the B-24s were far more plentiful in the war, both theaters. Cumulatively, the B-24s flew more missions, they delivered more bombs, and unfortunately, they also had higher casualty rates than the B-17s. Why were the B-17s singled out? Why was the B-24 given the short shift?
I'll give a short answer and then amplify on it a little bit. I think one of the chief reasons is that the B-24 is so ugly. To me, it looks like a mechanical elephant fitted with outriggers. But you're right. The B-24 was the most produced warplane in American history. It had longer range than the B-17, flew faster than the B-17. In fact, it displaced the B-17 in the Pacific after 1943. But it was also more difficult to fly. It was more difficult to maintain. It was harder. harder to operate. A lot of its systems, particularly its fuel system, was just kind of Rube Goldberg arrangement. And those sorts of things made it easier to manufacture. But the B-17, on the other hand, was easier to fly, easier to maintain, a good-looking aircraft compared to the B-24, and could sustain, as you indicated, quite a bit of damage, although a lot of B-24s came back with battle damage that really caused folks to wonder at its 30 to 50.
Just another example of good looks winning out in the end. My guest is Jay Stout. He's the author of the new book, Hell's Angels, The True Story of the 303rd Bomb Group in World War II. Jay, I've got to ask you, what one thing do you see differently after writing Hell's Angels?
I am struck in interviewing the veterans and going through their letters and diaries, it shouldn't be a surprise, but we tend to hold them on a pedestal, and rightly so in some respect, but the personalities are just the same as yours and mine. The work ethic, everything's there. They were just like us. They were just in a different time and place. Fortunately, they were able to rise to the occasion. But again, I look at a personality from one of these veterans and I go, well, he's just like so-and-so who I served with, or that's just like my friend's son, so-and-so. They were us, and that's not surprising considering we're their children or grandchildren or even now their great-great-grandchildren. My point being is that I think faced with the same thing, our young men and women could have performed just as well, and I think that's evidenced on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan.
That is great. Jay, if you've piqued the interest of some of my listeners, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go?
Well, certainly the 303rd Bomb Group maintains the best website having to do with this, and I would direct them to 303bg.com. It's a fantastic website, and certainly Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and fine independent bookstores everywhere will carry my work, and I'd be happy if they gave it a look.
Jay, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks so much, sir. Take care.